This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a copyright lawsuit targeting songwriter and performer Ed Sheeran was rejected, and a lot was riding on the outcome for the music of the future. Find out what's at stake and what it means to make original music. Now, the Wisconsin Legislature's Joint Finance Committee took its first actions on the state's next biennial budget over the course of the last week or so. In a 12-4 party-line vote, the committee removed 545 proposals and more than $4.5 billion from Governor Tony Evers' budget proposal. On Monday, we heard from a Democratic member of Joint Finance, State Senator LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee. You can listen to that interview online at WPR.org/Central Time. Our next guest is a Republican state senator from central Wisconsin and a member of the Joint Finance Committee, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your top priorities for Wisconsin's budget? Spending and taxes as well. What do you think about the way Wisconsin state budget is built? Do you have thoughts on the state's estimated $7 billion budget surplus and what, if anything, should be done with it? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Joan Ballweg has represented the 14th State Senate District in Central Wisconsin since 2021. Before that, she served in the State Assembly and was mayor of Markeson. Senator Ballweg also serves on the Joint Finance Committee. Senator Ballweg, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Now, your party has a majority in both chambers and, of course, on Joint Finance, but there's a Democrat in the governor's office now. Can you talk about your role in Joint Finance in coming up with a budget that's going to pass the legislature and get signed off on by the governor?
Well, hopefully the governor is going to see that it's a worthy budget that's good for all of Wisconsin, just as he did in the last two budget cycles were signed, with, of course, some vetoes. There isn't a I don't know if there's hardly a time when a governor hasn't used his powerful veto pen to, you know, to make some changes. But I think in the end, we'll come together. The governor will see that we can work together to get this moving forward.
Last week, the Joint Finance Committee agreed to build the budget from a base, meaning the current biennial budget, and voted to take a lot of items out of consideration from the governor's proposal. Can you talk about that foundation, using the current plan and working from there versus starting with the governor's plan? Why that decision?
Certainly. So it is traditional in both with Republican and Democratic governors that the majority party has looked to put us back, take out the policy items that are in the budget. What we passed last week was going back to the base budget, but then adding back in all of the revenue estimates, the things that need to keep things going just as they are with, covering our debt service, all of those kinds of things. So that was added in and we'll go from there. Now, when it comes to many of these policy items that were taken out of the budget, the philosophy is that instead of hiding them or tucking them away in the state budget, that if they're worthy to become law and become policy in Wisconsin, they should go through the regular legislative process, have the advocates be able to come in and address specifically whatever those items have to happen to be in standing committees, go through both houses of the legislature, and then the governor has the choice to either forward that, make that law, or veto it. And we just believe that's a better way to make policy. It's much more transparent.
There seems to be some agreement with the notion that with the state budget surplus, there ought to be some kind of tax cuts. The governor's budget proposal had included a tax cut for people making less than, I think it was $100,000, couples earning less than $150,000. I believe Joint Finance took that out. What is your vision for taxes in the budget?
Well, I think similar to what we've done in the last several budgets is to flatten those taxing levels, those taxing rates. Now, Majority Leader Lemahue has put forward a process which has gone through the first phase of having a public hearing. And I think at this point he realizes that we're not quite ready to do that, but we do need to keep up with our neighboring states that are going to flatter taxes. so that we are not holding back folks that want to come to Wisconsin and invest in Wisconsin. So I think there will be income tax reductions in this budget, and I hope that is a way that we do it by making those levels a little flatter than what they have been.
Then a bunch of items from the governor's proposed education budget were cut out, including a good amount of money, about $250 million for mental health services in schools. What are your thoughts for education funding and mental health in schools in particular?
Well, altogether, the governor's budget and the DPI budget, you know, is in the area of $2.7 million. Now, I know everyone talks about we have this $7.1 billion surplus, but most of that, a good share of that, is one-time money. So we should be investing in things that are one-time efforts. That's why I think you see a very serious effort in trying to do some catch-up when it comes to our municipalities and our counties, when it comes to shared revenue. So that is a big part of our interest right now. Same thing, the governor had $2 billion in cash in his capital budget. So there's a lot of ways that we can spend one-time money. Now, we have been increasing the subsidies when it comes to mental health support, not only in our schools, but for our counties that are responsible for a lot of that, for both our adult population and so those with disabilities. So we continue to take a look at that piece of the budget. And then when it comes to schools, in addition, over the last several budgets, not the last one, because the ESSER money or the federal money was put into the schools, we have continued to increase our support for special needs students in our schools. I see that we'll be continuing to do that, and we'll take a look again at some increases in per pupil funding and maybe raising something I would like to do, especially would affect the vast majority of school districts in the 14th Senate District, is increase the floor of spending levy limits for our school districts.
Talking to State Senator Joan Baldwin, Republican on the Joint Finance Committee, looking at the big news in the state budget and related issues. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's go to our callers now. Mike starts us off in Wauwatosa. Mike, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Mike?
I believe that we should take a billion or two of that surplus and put it into infrastructure. Well, one-third infrastructure and two-thirds roads, because the roads around here are terrible.
Mike, thanks for the call. Senator Baldwin, I know you have your eyes on roads, especially ones that farmers rely on to transport their goods. Your thoughts for Mike?
Well, certainly when Mike talks about infrastructure, I think that goes to putting some of this cash into the building commission projects, which many of them have to do with our university academic buildings, some of the reimagining for how we might be using our state office buildings also. There are some proposals when it comes to that. Our state historic society is looking for some additional cash to put into that project as well, among many others. And as you mentioned, there is a proposal that I am supporting that is being led by Senator Mark Lyon in the Senate, which is a special allocation for $150 million that would take a look at finding high priority roads in our rural areas that are going to support our agricultural community. Because we've heard from our local municipalities, and mainly the towns, that as equipment gets bigger, as the milk trucks get bigger, it takes beating on the road. So if we can identify and beef up the specifications of some of those roads, it'd be good for Wisconsin agriculture, the second leading economic driver here in the state.
Mike, thanks for that call. Mac is with us now in Milwaukee. Mac, hello.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Mac. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, I was happy your guest brought up shared revenue. I was wondering, my only guess as to why Milwaukee would get so much less than the residents of small towns and municipalities is because the budget committee knows that it's impossible to have both low density and low taxes while maintaining high services. So this is like a surcharge on high density areas to pay for services in low density areas. But I'm not sure why the guests, what the guests answer for why Milwaukee gets so little money in shared revenue.
Mac, thanks for the call. As Senator Bowick, Mac, bringing up, of course, the shared revenue, a big fiscal item that's outside of the budget, at least at present. And some analyses, have shown that small communities get really big percentage increases, while the Milwaukee's, Green Bay's, and some other cities get about a 10% increase. What are your thoughts for Mac?
Well, if you take a look at the big picture of what's been happening in the past, that those towns were not getting their fair share when it came to shared revenue all along the way. You know, when Mac and someone comes up to our lakes and rivers on vacation and they call 911, they expect the same kind of service that they had when they're in the city. And with being a mainly volunteer-based system over the years, we just can't sustain that anymore. So that's one of the areas that we really have been struggling in rural areas that we needed to beef up. But in general, if you look at the numbers, those rural areas have not been getting their share of all the money that was coming in and going out for shared revenue. So this is a bit of a catch-up with their with the surplus that we have available to us right now and going forward, in then using that shared revenue formula to make sure that when it's tied to increases in sales tax revenue, there will be a general increase. Not every year does sales tax go up, but the majority of years, and the municipalities and the counties and towns know that, they will be getting a natural increase also. So I think we're just trying to fair up some of those shared revenue allocations.
Mac, thanks for that call. We're talking to Republican State Senator Joan Bollweg, who represents the 14th Senate District. That includes Marquette and Green Lake counties, most of Columbia and Waupaca counties. She's one of 12 Republicans on the 16-member Joint Finance Committee. We're looking at the committee's ongoing work to build the next two-year state budget, plus that shared revenue overhaul. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your priorities for the new budget of Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with State Senator Joan Bollweg, one of a dozen Republicans on the 16-member Joint Finance Committee. We're looking at the process of building Wisconsin's next two-year budget. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your priorities, your questions. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Black River Falls. Chris, hi.
Hi. I've been frustrated by the Republican budget for many years, but I have three things that I would really like to see Wisconsin invest in. Number one is, I believe it's the I-39 corridor, which heads north from Madison to the north central part of the state. I'd like to see that completed all the way to the Highway 2 as well. Duluth, Minnesota is increasing their port size to be able to receive more international shipping. So on the Superior side, we have the Fraser shipyards, which do a lot of the repair of those big ships and also help load. I'd like to see some money invested in expanding of that, and hopefully that would help expand business within the state.
Chris, I gotcha. Two big infrastructure items there, Senator Bollweg, 39 up to Highway 2 and the Port in Superior.
Well, there are some projects going on Highway 39, but they're a little bit south of you folks. We're focusing right now on that corridor that's going from Madison up through Wisconsin Dells. You're going to be seeing the expansion of those bridges so that they can do the expansion of the roads. I know I drive I-39 quite a bit when I'm coming from the Capitol and going up to the district. And so there's going to be a lot of construction going on right now through that corridor. And I am so on board with the idea of trying to get more capacity at our ports. There has been expansion at the Milwaukee port that is going to greatly help our agriculture industry. One of the bills I led that was in the budget last term and will be renewing it again this term is focusing on an increase of agricultural exports in Wisconsin. We've seen just in the 12 to 15 months it's been active an over 30% increase in the exports of dairy. But we have a lot of things that we could put onto the ports with our grains, with our wood products. I'd also like to see that we actually put in a container terminal somewhere here in the state so we don't have to keep trucking things down to the rail yards in Chicago. I think that would be also a great opportunity. And I have talked to both the Department of Transportation Secretary and the DATCAP Secretary about some of that planning that I think we need to get on. So I totally agree.
Chris, thanks for the call. Michael joins us now in Northwest Wisconsin. Michael, hi.
Hi there. About the Medicare expansion. I see it's been adopted by Republican and Democratic states alike because of like the expansion of services and subsidies. And why it has continued to be rejected in Wisconsin.
Michael, thanks for the call. I don't know if you could hear the line while Senator Bolick talking about the Medicaid expansion. Wisconsin, one of a handful of states, not taking it. I don't know if that's in Republicans' plans, but I know you have an interest in a particular thing when it comes to postnatal care.
That's right. So here in Wisconsin, we do have a more generous participation for postpartum care in Wisconsin with folks that are at 306% of the federal poverty limit. And right now, last budget, we passed that there should be a 90-day coverage. CMS in Washington, D.C. has not authorized that at this point. But what we're really looking for is 12 months. There is just so much science on trying to make sure that mom and baby, who is also covered if they are VeggieCare eligible, up to those 12 months, that it would be a way for mom to stay healthier. And in pregnancies, we see some chronic conditions that are exacerbated, and they don't go away the day the baby is born. So we need to be able to keep track of moms, especially if they're having some issues. And then we don't see the effects or the onset of postpartum depression within those first 3 months usually either. There, a lot of times it's not happening until 6 months or after. So being able to have consistent care is something that we really think is important. It was back in 2018 when I started taking a look at this when it comes to maternal morbidity. We had a DHS study, and that council came together and said that this expansion is something that is one of their key elements in trying to help moms be healthier. And, of course, it's healthier for a family and for a young one when mom is there. And so that is the focus that I have right now to drill down and try to get to a 12-month postpartum coverage. We have 69 co-sponsors in the legislature. We have over 40 organizations that are out there knocking on doors around the Capitol, encouraging their legislators to support this. And I hope it's going to happen this term.
And to our caller's wider point, Wisconsin, again, is one of the states that hasn't expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Governor Evers has proposed it in his budget, taken back out in joint finance. What's your case for not taking that expansion of federal Medicaid funding?
Well, we have done things a little bit differently in Wisconsin when that came up back under the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. And yes, there would be more folks that would be covered it because it does take that eligibility up to 138% of the federal poverty limit. But you know, that's not free. There is money that is that does have to go out of the state coffers to pay for that. But what we're really proud of is that of the 10 states that haven't expanded, we're the only state in the nation, expanded or not, having no coverage gaps. And so our theory is we're covering individuals up to 100% of the federal poverty level. And at that point, folks are eligible to go onto the federal exchange and then eligible for the federal subsidy. So in other words, let's not make Wisconsin the middleman and have folks go to the exchange where they can get those direct federal subsidies based on what their income level is and what their premiums would be.
Thanks again for that call. It's Senator Ballwig. Thanks again for joining us today.
Happy to be with you anytime.
That's State Senator Joan Ballwig. She represents the 14th Senate District in central Wisconsin. She joined us today with a look at ongoing state budget deliberations and some of the top priorities in the Wisconsin State Legislature. Earlier this week, I talked to a Democratic member of the Joint Finance Committee, State Senator LaTanya Johnson. You can find that interview online at WPR.org/Central Time. A lot of callers. Sorry to those who didn't get onto the air. But if you have a question, some particular aspect of the state budget, whether it's the process and how it works or a particular line item, something you're wondering about why more money isn't being spent on or less money or about taxes, let us know. And we can maybe key in on that in a future conversation. Email us right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the pandemic emergency officially ends tomorrow under a declaration from the federal government. Find out what that means and look back at efforts to limit the impact of COVID-19 and ahead at preparations for future disease outbreaks. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. As of last night, there's a new winner and a new breed of winner in the annual Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. And great news, the breed name makes me have to try to say something in French, which is never good. The Best in Show winning dog's name is Buddy Holly. That's the easy part. The breed, for the first time ever, is spelled Petit Basset Griffon Vendéen, but pronounced something like Petit Basset Griffon Vendéen. It's also known as PBGV. It's a cool-looking dog, according to the American Kennel Club. They're known for being good at hunting rabbits, and they have, quote, a happy demeanor and durable constitution. As far as appearance, I would describe them as kind of fluffy. I'm not good at describing things. Do you have a dog in your life that wins your personal Best in Show award? Send us pictures. Email idea@WPR.org. Rave on about your dog. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we take a look at an unsuccessful copyright lawsuit against songwriter and performer Ed Sheeran and what it means for the future of music. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum remembering a woman whose life was cut far too short. We share the story in honor of the recent Missing or Murdered Indigenous Persons Awareness Day.
Menominee tribal member Ray Elaine Turtelot was 18 when she went missing on the tribe's reservation during the fall of 1986. Tribal police and the FBI found her remains the following spring. Her daughter, Elise Arce, and relative Andrea Lemke Roshan sat down to talk about Ray with WPR's Daniel Kading. They also shared their hopes for a new task force that's focused on murdered and missing Indigenous women in Wisconsin.
My name is Elise Arce. I'm Ray's daughter.
I'm Andrea Lemke Roshan, and I'm Ray Elaine's cousin and friend. Ray Elaine was pure joy. She and I grew up together. We were kids. She lived on the reservation and I didn't. So I loved whenever we would go visit. She was laughing all the time. She was a huge joker and just a really beautiful girl and a really beautiful young woman. And that beauty radiated really from the inside out.
I just know that she was really outgoing and she had a lot of spirit and a lot of lift. She loved to dance, powwow dance. She was a Menominee princess. She was very into our culture, singing and drumming class, Menominee language.
The time we would spend together, she would try to teach me Menominee. She tried to teach me to dance. She told me I was a hopeless dancer. I never quite could do it, but she was a gorgeous dancer. She did fancy dancing, and that's supposed to mimic a butterfly. And Ray Elaine looked like a butterfly embodied when she danced. It was just really beautiful.
And she was very family oriented.
I hadn't seen Elise in a few years, and I had gone back up for a family gathering at my cousin Ray's sister's house. And Elise and I, Elise, you were a teenager, but we were on a pontoon boat ride together. And Elise threw her head back and laughed. And I thought, oh my God, there she is. There's Ray. There's Ray Lane right there, right in front of me.
It's nice to hear stuff like that because a part of me feels like she's living through me. She's always around me all the time.
I remember getting a message saying, you need to call home right away. It was in October of 1986. And I called home and my mom was sobbing. She just couldn't even get the words out to tell me that Ray was missing. And I couldn't wrap my head around it because I knew she had just given birth to Elise.
I was only 2 months old when this happened. This was something that kind of shook our whole reservation from what I know, because my aunties kept newspaper clippings and everything from way back then.
We learned that part of her body had been found in a beaver dam on the reservation. So it was very, very hard.
I just don't want any other family to go through what we went through. I see and I know the pain of my family because I can see it in their eyes and how they are.
I think this missing and murdered Indigenous women work is the first time that I feel like there's something tangible that I can do to try to make a difference. We really do want to raise awareness that this is a problem impacting Native women and Native girls, and we need it to stop, and we want it to stop.
It's something that needs to be fixed within the system, and that's why I'm saying, like, I don't want any other family dealing with what we are dealing with. I don't want people going off with cold cases for 34 years. I don't want them to have this pain that we carry around with us every day. That's what I want out of this, because I mean, and I feel like that would be her only justice of this, is to help other families, because nobody should ever have to feel what we felt.
WPR's Danielle Kading brought us that story, remembering Ray Elaine Turtelot, a Menominee tribal member who was killed in 1986. Her family is participating in the new Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Now, what makes a song unique? Is it the voice of the person singing it, the lyrics, the bass line, the melody, the chord progression? What if one song really reminds you of another song? Has one artist copied another, or is inspiration more complicated than that? These questions are in the news after an unsuccessful lawsuit against Ed Sheeran for his song Thinking Out Loud, which heirs of songwriter Ed Townsend claimed was a copy of the 1973 classic Let's Get It On, which Townsend had co-written with Marvin Gaye. We're talking about copyright infringement and creative freedom when it comes to music. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are there songs that you think are just plain ripoffs of other songs? Do you have questions about how the law applies to musical creativity? Have you been following this particular case against Ed Sheeran? What do you think of the songs and the verdict? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jim Jesse is an attorney and musician who specializes in music law. He's also the founder of Rock and Roll Law, an organization providing continuing education for lawyers on music copyright law. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, hang on while we get a taste of each of the songs in this particular case. We'll start with the 1973 Marvin Gaye classic, Let's Get It On. Okay, that's the older song in this lawsuit, and now here's Ed Sheeran with Thinking Out Loud.
Darling, I will be loving you till we're 70.
Okay, Jim, a chord progression on the verse there, spot on. I think they're a half step apart, I read. Melody, very different. So how does a case like this end up in court?
Well, Ed Townsend, apparently, or his estate, he actually passed away in 2003. You know, sued Ed Sheeran. Sheeran did not settle, so it I guess, had enough merit to go to trial. I agree with you. There's a general sort of the feel is similar. The vibe, maybe the same chords, yeah, as you said. Chords are not copyrightable, though, because then no one would be able to write songs. So, you know, and if the melody's not similar, that's a lot of the song. I mean, obviously, you mentioned a lot of the other elements that are in songs. You know, and obviously, there's expert testimony on both sides. And a jury found that the plaintiff did not meet their burden of proof.
Now, with cases like this, copyright cases, a songwriter or a songwriter's estate sues another songwriter. Do we have a really good, solid foundation of law, or is it, hey, if you can convince this jury in this case, you win, and maybe a different jury would have read it differently, and it's just kind of up in the air?
Yes, juries do strange things sometimes, so obviously they're the ultimate deciders of the facts and the law. I mean, it's all court-made law, a lot of these cases. This one was in New York or California here, a lot of these cases. I mean, there's two main things a plaintiff has to prove. One is access. Okay, you can't copy something unless you've heard it. I don't think Sheeran denied wouldn't be very believable if he said, I never heard. Let's get it on. Apparently, he had sung both at a concert. That was the plaintiff's, I guess, smoking gun evidence. And then you have to prove similarity, substantial similarity, not just kind of similar. And then there's expert testimony on both sides. And then a jury basically has to decide, is the only reason, you know, these similarities is from copying rather than, you know, you just happen to create it independently and it sounds alike, which is possible.
I want to go back to 1976 and a successful case, songwriter John Mack against George Harrison. Now, here's John Mack's song performed by the Chiffons, He's So Fine. Okay, and then here's George Harrison, My Sweet Lord. Okay, so this was a successful lawsuit, Jim, and the focus was on the melody here. And it seems like if anything is going to get you in trouble, apart from just ripping off somebody's lyrics, I guess, it's going to be if your melody is spot on, as it was in this case, that other song. Is that a good smoking gun in a lawsuit like this?
Yeah, I mean, and obviously if the lyrics are the same, that's going to be
that's a
pretty
cover.
You don't need to go to trial for that. Yes. And in this case, this is an interesting case for a lot of reasons. Harrison, this is his first post-Beatles solo debut. It's a triple album, All Things Must Pass. Comes out late 1970. The reviewer in Rolling Stone magazine actually says, boy, this sounds a lot like, you know, My Sweet Lord sounds a lot like He's So Fine. The publisher sues Harrison, the publisher of he's so fine. The case doesn't go to trial until 76. So obviously Harrison didn't deny. I mean, he'd heard the Serge Fant song, He's So Fine, came out in the early 60s. So similarity, you know, again, I suspect there's similar chords, you know, and subconsciously, you know, all songwriters love music, you know, and they listen to lots of music, and some of it may seep in. If you use similar chords, chords are groups of notes played together, usually on a piano or guitar. The likelihood of you singing the same melody, you know, you can only sing certain notes within those chords, is therefore increased. Yeah, and it went to trial. The judge, by the way, had composed an opera, so he knew something of music law, or music apparently, and he found that, quote, it was the same song with different lyrics. Ouch, poor George. And yeah.
And I was reading back to the coverage at the time. The judge, I believe, said, I don't think George Harrison, I don't think you did this on purpose. I don't think this was a deliberate theft, but it was so close that the effect was the same as if he'd stolen it.
Exactly. And I don't think any songwriter deliberately does it. Again, you might be inspired to write something. You might, like I said, similar chords, maybe subconsciously he heard it. You know, songs come about, and I also write songs, you know, mysteriously. They just kind of, you know, it's a stroke of lightning sometimes. And so, you know, and there's a lot of songs out there. And so the likelihood of them sounding alike is there, you know, or at least somewhat alike, is therefore greater, particularly, like I said, when you're using, you know, in the rock and pop realm, there's certain chords that sound good together, and lots of songs use the same chords.
We're talking to music law expert Jim Jesse about music copyright law after a high-profile lawsuit against songwriter and performer Ed Sheeran was rejected. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think counts as plagiarism when it comes to music in particular? What's the difference between being inspired by something and kind of ripping it off? Are you a songwriter yourself? Have you ever accidentally rewritten somebody else's song? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with music law expert Jim Jesse about music, copyrights, and when a song is too close for comfort to another song. This comes after a rejected lawsuit against songwriter and performer Ed Sheeran. You can join in if you have questions about how this works. If there's a song you think is suable, it's too similar to another song you've encountered. Musicians out there, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jim, I want to talk about what's at stake in suits like this. We had Ed Sheeran saying, you know, he's a popular songwriter and performer, and he was saying, I would get out of songwriting, maybe out of music, if this case is successful, for fear of future lawsuits. We heard other people kind of along those lines. If there are a lot of rulings on these borderline cases against songwriters, is there a concern that, all right, people aren't going to write more songs?
I think that's overstated. I mean, I don't think anyone has not written a song because they're afraid of getting sued. You write songs because you're inspired to do so. You know, there was, you know, so no, I don't think that's the reality. Obviously, Ed Sheeran's high profile. Look, if the Townsend estate had won, potentially they step into the shoes of Ed Sheeran and make all the money he made off of his song, and possibly even some of the album sales as well, because people may buy an album or CD based upon that particular song. So I understand the risk there. But, you know, and these are high profile cases that make the news, but, you know, it's not that common that these cases occur.
Now, I'm a musician. I don't write songs precisely because every time I come up with a brilliant song idea, I pretty soon realize, oh, it's exactly an awesome song that somebody else already wrote. How much, if I were to take the chance and start putting out songs like that, how much due diligence do I have to do? What do I have to do to cover myself when inevitably somebody realizes, Rob, you just wrote this other song?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you just, I guess, run it by other people. Obviously, you may think it's original. I guess just knowing yourself, I mean, Look, the odds, it's going to, you know, all music is derivative if you drill down to a granular enough level. You know, and frankly, I have enough trouble getting people to listen to my music, let alone suing me for copyright infringement. So I don't think it's, like I said, the cases tend to be high-profile people as defendants, maybe higher profile or slightly less profile. I mean, I dare say everybody's heard of the Let's Get It On, but, you know, very few people have probably heard of Ed Townsend before this lawsuit. And obviously the Sheeran song, was it Thinking Out Loud, you know, huge hit, millions of tens of millions of streams, et cetera. So I don't know. I don't think there's a foolproof way to know, to be honest.
We are talking about the finer points of musical copyright law when inspiration turns into imitation and even intellectual property theft. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jim Jesse is with us. He's an attorney and musician who specializes in music law. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Got a question from Gary in Jackson who couldn't come on the air, but he wonders, what about Weird Al? So what about parody, Jim? What kind of cover is that? Is there legally if I want to do a parody of a song?
Good question. Weird Al always gets permission. Obviously uses the same melody. He could argue it's some sort of fair use exception, but Weird Al always gets permission from the writers or owners of the song he is parodying. So that's not a straight up cover. Now, a straight up cover is if I covered Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye and I pay a small royalty to, you know, whoever owns the song or the publisher, I can cover it, you know, as long as I don't change the melody or the lyrics appreciably. You know, I can certainly change the arrangement. We've all heard cover songs that are vastly different arrangements. So, by the way, I thought of a way, Rob, for you to write a song.
Ooh.
Play it in a Shazam app and then see if it comes up as anything. Okay, there you go.
Excellent.
There's your answer.
I'll try that next time. I want to ask about law and sampling, Jim, because the late Clyde Stubblefield, the original funky drummer, longtime resident of Wisconsin, he passed away a few years back. I talked to him in this room, and he was very unhappy with the use of his funky drummer beat in zillions of rap and other songs, and money not going to him. What is the state of the art of the law when it comes to building a song off of a sample of someone like Clyde Stubblefield?
Yeah, and that's too bad. I mean, I'll tell you what the law is. It's like speeding, though. I'm not sure everybody follows the law.
Mm-hmm.
But it's if you've got to clear it. I mean, and so I don't know. If you use the actual sounds in another subsequent recording, you've got to clear it with whoever owns the, what is called the sound recording or the master recording. And then you always have to clear it with the songwriter or publisher. So now I will say this too, something in order to be copyrightable has to be what is called original. Original is a low bar, but you know, playing drums on the 2 and 4 beat is not original. You know, playing the D, C, G on a guitar is not original. Could be done in original ways and that's potentially copyrightable, but you know, it has to have a minimal or modicum of creativity. So not everything's copyrightable, and that gets us back to the Sheeran case. You know, just because songs have the same general feel or vibe, that's just not enough. It's too broad. It's too vague, if that helps.
Sure.
Samples, clear your samples. No set rate. You just negotiate. By the way, that's why you see, you know, songs by Beyonce with 20 co-writers, because they're all, you know, clearing the samples and they're putting them on as songwriters.
Let's bring on a caller. Celia is with us in Madison. Celia, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for this opportunity. I have a manuscript on women in World War II, and the normal quote for acceptable quote without getting permission from a textbook or, you know, a work, a written work, is 300 words. But I quote like 7 to 10 words from the very popular song, I'll Be Seeing You, you know, the small park across the way, et cetera.
See, we don't have a lot of time. Jim, I know this is maybe a little outside your area. Can an author quote a World War II standard in brief?
Yes. I mean, there's no set, you know, there's no word cutoff, though. It's just, it goes to fair use. I mean, obviously, if you reprint the whole song, Celia, I think that would be an issue. But if you're just printing a line or two, it's probably fair use. I mean, I can't, you know, say for certain, but, you know, again, assuming the song's not in the public domain, if a song's in the public domain, then anybody can use it. There's no permissions needed.
Celia, thanks a lot for the call. And Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Jim Jesse, an attorney and musician who specializes in music law. He's the founder of Rock and Roll Law. That's an organization that provides continuing education for lawyers on music copyright law. He talked to us today about the verdict in a copyright lawsuit against songwriter Ed Sheeran over Sheeran's song Thinking Out Loud. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, TV and movie writers went on strike last week. Find out about the contract issues that led to the walk-off and what it can end up meaning for the movies and TV shows we watch. Plus, we'll look at loneliness, social connection, and the places we connect, and places where we don't have places to connect out in public. You can share your thoughts right now at ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, dig into the history and culture of different regions of the United States and how they fit into modern-day gun violence statistics. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.